Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China stocks swoon as the coronavirus spreads. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has a rough week as Boeing's woes continue and there are more tax cuts in the works. Our guest today, Claire Flynn Levy from Essentia Analytics. All this and much more on episode number 646 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm your host. Thank you so much for tuning in. I don't know about you, but there's been a cold snap down here in Florida. We've had 39 degrees in the overnight this week, and I know you feel sorry for me. Oh, my gosh, 39, especially for those of you that are up north. But, you know, I had to turn on the heater in the car for the first time in a while. So hope you're keeping warm and don't get all upset and this guy is complaining about 39 degrees. I'm sitting here in 4 degrees below zero and man, it's tough, but I get it. Don't forget those times in the summer that we're in 90 degrees and 99.9% humidity, where it's pretty tough down here. So it's a, you know, give and take all for all sides of where you live. I spent some time this week with Frank Curzio on his The Wall Street. I'm thinking DH Unplugged. The Wall Street Unplugged podcast, his great podcast where he does each and every week and brings some great information, some tremendous guests. And I had the nice opportunity to spend some time talking with him and talking about all sorts of areas about the markets, information related to a couple of stocks. I think we had three different stocks we talked about in particular, as well as covering a broad range of topics that are really important right now in the world of investing and finance. So make sure to check that out. Just look up Frank Curzio's Wall Street Unplugged. You can find it anywhere that great podcasts are sold. You know, just go over there and get it. Well, another week, and it seemed with earnings season out that generally speaking, things are pretty much in line. There's not a lot of surprises, a couple here and there, but for the most part, we're seeing that there's generally good news from a lot of companies. Most companies are beating on the estimates. A couple of companies didn't do so well. But generally, there was this thought of, well, smooth sailing. Things were good. But all of a sudden, we get this new wrinkle, right? We get this outbreak of the coronavirus that not only is centric to Asia, but starting to spread around the world. Now, we're getting a lot of reports, you know, how many hundreds of people are now infected and unfortunately several dozen deaths at this point and causing all sorts of concerns in the area of Asia. A few cases in the United States, but mostly again in Asia. And China stocks sold off really hard on this. The government is trying to shut this down as quick as possible because the concentration of people in China is so incredibly tight that any virus that will spread from person to person can spread very, very quickly. So they're closing off the entire city of Wuhan, where this initially emanated from. Travel in and out is closed, and even they stopped the ride-sharing programs as this outbreak is centered right there. And so far, the WHO, the World Health Organization, is not claiming this to be severe enough, although it was a split decision, that they would consider it to be a global outbreak or a global infestation or maybe even a pandemic. So that's good news. We saw that stocks rebounded on that news, but we're still in a questionable period as to who's really monitoring this and the reporting, if it's high quality and where this is spreading. But it's a real big problem. And even so, not much is really impacting the United States markets. The resilient and Teflon-coated U.S. markets, where we saw some sell-off on this news, particularly those stocks that were related to China. And one of the reasons is that the U.S. is still considered a pretty safe bet right now. And we have the reasons that we know that, well, we have a good trajectory of economics and earnings. We see that fiscal and monetary policy is favorable. Plus, we have a bullish trend. So all these things are really pulling money into the U.S. markets, pushing money into the U.S. markets. And as earnings are solid, and now even talk about potentially a middle-class tax cut, even though the deficits and the debt is rising to uncontrollable levels, and maybe it's a political stunt, who knows. But Mnuchin, Secretary Mnuchin, announced this week that we are now looking at the potential for tax cuts, another round of tax cuts. Who knows where that will go and what that will be, but they're sort of tinkering around with ideas on that, and that definitely helped the markets a bit. And of course, that fiscal policy stimulus will be very beneficial for the U.S. economy overall. Not so much for our debt, not so much for the deficit, but for consumers. Now, this week was very, I would say, light calendar. We had a partial week for trading markets as we saw the observation of the MLK Jr. holiday. But next week is a pretty busy schedule, both on the calendar for economics and for earnings. We're going to see durable goods, the first read on GDP for the fourth quarter. We're going to see a Fed rate decision, PCE prices, along with personal spending and income, plus a huge number of companies are going to be reporting next week earnings. And more importantly, we're going to start to see the tech bellwethers pour in with what they have. And as we saw that incredible run over the last several months for some of these names and the multiple expansion, the question is going to be whether or not earnings are going to be on the trajectory that were estimated and planned for and hoped for to allow for this rally to keep running on these major names that are really those names that are holding up the markets. So we're going to be watching for that. But with that, let's get right to our guest this week. I know it's going to be a great discussion. And our guest today, we're welcoming back Claire Flynn Levy from Essentia Analytics. And she has a deep knowledge of areas revolving around, well, behavioral finance and active management, as well as a whole host of interesting tidbits on how to make sure that you're not really falling prey to some of your worst habits. I guess that would be a interesting way of putting it. So, Claire, it's been a while. I think we were together the last time in July.
That's right. That's the summer. It feels like ages ago.
It does. Everything going well on your side of the woods there up in Connecticut?
Yeah. Things are good, especially the number of people who have New Year's resolutions around their investment decision-making is growing.
That's an interesting phenomenon, because that does go into the whole idea of behavior and how people have these benchmarks, right? So I'm going to eat like crazy through Christmas and Thanksgiving, and then, I'm just going to go on this diet in January. And when you see, I'm always fascinated about the amount of cars that are at the local fitness club around on January and how that seems to thin out a little bit towards July.
It is true. It thins out a little bit towards February. Yeah, right.
But what is that all about? I mean, what do people utilize these kinds of dates? Is it just something where they can hang their hat on?
Well, there's been a bunch of research around this idea, and Dan Pink wrote a book about timing a couple of years ago now that goes into that phenomenon in particular around fitness. But at the end of the day, people have a higher success rate at changing their behavior when they start that new behavior on the first day of a new period, a period of a calendar year is being the most powerful one, but even a Monday as a new period of a week. There's something about that sense of cycle that we have in the sense of new beginning that is extra motivating and feels like a clean slate. And so people who start then instead of on, you know, July 12th or whatever random date, have a better shot at success. I mean, that said, lots and lots of people put, you know, lots of goals down on paper on January 1st and then lose those completely or, you know, stop making any effort towards achieving them by the end of January. So, making a goal and sticking with it is hard even then, but yeah. You have a better shot when you start with this sort of feeling of clean slate and new beginning.
Now, you mentioned something about just now about writing it down. Some people write down their goals and they then, you know, hopefully can stick to them, et cetera. I've always found, and I've always talked about how writing something down is a very powerful way of trying to stick to something. And I've always had the thought that, well, if I just think it, it's one thing. If I say it, it's another. But if I write it down, and I'm not talking about necessarily putting it down in a notepad, which maybe some people do in your computer on a Word document. I'm talking about physically taking a pen and writing it down and then having it as a reference in a readily accessible place to reference it. Is there something that is in your research that, you know, writing it down and committing to something versus just verbally committing something is much more achievable?
Yeah, I mean, so the physical writing it part is something that I've read a certain amount about, and therapists often are big proponents of this. Something about the act of writing it, and you know, in some cases they'll tell you to write something down and then crumple it up and throw it away, and that's sort of symbolic. And people say that actually is a powerful experience for them and lets them let go of that thing, maybe. What we do at Essentia is all, you know, computer-based, and so there's not a lot of writing things by hand. But what we do is prompt our clients to write down why they're doing what they're doing at any given time. So that act of even typing it out, you know, you're like committing that for posterity. And so you do think harder about it. And then later you can do analysis and see, oh, so every time I enter a new position on this basis, it tends to be a good call. But every time I do it on that basis, it tends to be a bad call. So there's a practical advantage to writing everything down. But even more powerful than writing it down, we've found is later being nudged about it. So I just went through
this exercise. So that's writing it down and either giving it to somebody or making it a way that it is bounced back to you.
Yeah. So you know, imagine if you set yourself a goal for 2020 and we said, all right, what's one question you could be asking yourself every day that would prompt you to, you know, make more effort towards that goal? So I literally have done this for myself, and I have a goal of spending, like, connecting and spending more quality time with my kids. And so I've set up this nudge, and, you know, it's very similar to what we do with our clients who are trading. And it asked me once a day, I forget exactly what the wording we agreed was, but it something along the lines of, have you gone for a walk with your older son, or have you had a conversation with your younger son? And the answer to that on any given day might be no or yes, and who knows? But just looking at that and being reminded that I did say I wanted to do more of that. Okay, I've got that in my head now. Let's do it. Let's have a conversation. That is very powerful. And it's actually not that hard.
Right. I mean, until it gets to a point that maybe it's something that, like, you look at and you're like, well, historically, I said no to that discussion with my younger son 20 times, but I said yes to having a walk with my older son. What's going on there? Not that you may be favoring one or the other, but maybe, you know, hey, I didn't realize it was really like that. It gives you a reality point on what you're actually doing.
Exactly. Right, and then you could say, okay, so I'm probably doing the walking one because I value the walk as much as the conversation.
Right.
So maybe I should go for a walk with the younger kid too.
Yeah. Which then leads you to change your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's
the whole point here, is to better yourself and to make sure. And when we bring it home to the idea of investors, it's the idea of, hey, you're making this decision and it's been a bad decision. And maybe you didn't know it was, because when you kind of don't have all of this very clearly laid out in front of you, what happens is that it looks like, oh, look at all my winners. You know, we always like talk about our winners, right? Oh, man, I made all that money on that stock. But you forget about that other one. Ah, it was a small loss. But maybe you had five of those small losses that added up on that particular security or particular pattern or rationale of how you're investing. So maybe a reminder would be helpful. Now, I wanted to skip forward and then we're going to go back to that for a second. I want to talk about the idea of, you know, behavioral finance. And what are you finding these days that is the discussion about the current market environment that really sticks out to you right now? Because I think there is a lot of things that are very interesting about where we are today, or maybe the last, you know, year, let's say. And maybe something that sticks out, any other historical analogs that you can bring forth that you're seeing out there?
That's a good question. I mean, we're mostly focused on working with very long-term investors. So what we're noticing amongst them is a certain level of calm. I mean, kind of surprisingly, right? There's so much going on all the time that each one of these events is worthy of rocking the market, and yet somehow we've become sort of impervious to things. But that's in part because there are fund managers out there who are saying, I'm taking a long-term view and what I'm interested in is corporate earnings, you know, and that's certainly the case in the fundamental equity world where we live. So they're waiting for the proof to be in the pudding and are gathering data and you know, doing analysis in between earnings releases that helps them try to anticipate if things are going the way that they've bet things are going to go. So they're not really reacting to day-to-day, you know, global news unless it has a clear effect on earnings.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for example, you may have somebody who's really bullish on the airlines and things have been going along swimmingly for some time, except for the Boeing disaster. And, you know, that may have said, well, okay, but yet we saw that some of the airlines actually pulled through that pretty well. And then you're like, okay, well, wait a second. What about this coronavirus thing? And that's definitely has an impact on the airlines. Is that going to be a momentary issue or is that going to be a long-term issue? And how are the airlines going to deal with that? Or even say, well, look what's going on with the Saudi drone bombing and the Iran issue and the oil prices. I mean, so a lot of the things, it's been really interesting that I've found that maybe the calm is because of resolutions have been very swift. You know,
yeah.
I mean, things are like, you know, all these bad things and it's like, okay, like the Iran thing, it was like 23-hour war in Iran. I mean, what was that? That was like nothing happened.
Well, and I guess, you know, certainly the fund managers that we work with, when they're entering a new position, you know, part of writing it down is saying, okay, this is why I'm going into this position. Here's how I'll know that I'm right, and here's how I know that I'm wrong. And so when an event happens, whether it's a virus or you know, a war or whatever, they can look at that and say, okay, is it any of those things? Like I said, I would know if I was wrong if, I mean, even if it was airlines, if passenger numbers started to slip by greater than X percent, or I don't know, I'm not an airline expert, but, you know, there would be some indicator that there's something structurally happening or sustained happening, not a short-term news item that where we're not really sure what the effect is going to be. But if you look at something like Boeing, you know, you could see fundamental investors looking at the reason that they were holding it in the first place and say, oh, well, the culture of the organization and the management, that is maybe my thesis is broken now. Probably a little late in
But meanwhile, yes, Boeing is down, but it isn't like it. If you saw this in another name, with the combination of what's going on with the halt to production, the grounding, and then the culture issue, which is a major issue with the CEO, you know, basically everybody loved him, but then they're like, wait a minute, this guy sucks. And then, you know, when he stepped down. But the stock really hasn't reacted very much. Another relatively calm moment. It's definitely down and has not done what the market's done. So it was up 2% last year. All right. Markets were up 30%. Okay. Much lower than the return of the market. But still, you know, 2 to 5 to 7% per year for a stock, not too bad on a long-term basis, yet not a big reaction in the name. So, I mean, again, this calm issue, I think, is I don't know if it's good or it's bad. All this complacency.
I don't know either, but I think we've been through, I've certainly as a fund manager lived through periods like that before and wonder, I never got to the bottom of exactly why it was happening because you can speculate all you want. You never really know for sure why people are so calm, but it is an eerie feeling when you're in it.
Yeah. Now you've done work on what you've called the alpha cycle. This is what I wanted to get back to here. And I think we covered this a little bit in our last discussion back in July. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this and then relate it back to the average investor. So can you kind of go through that again, the alpha cycle?
Yeah. Well, so every time any one of us buys a position for our portfolio, you know, we call that a trading episode and that position has a life in your portfolio, and hopefully it is a life during which alpha gets accumulated. Ideally, just absolute dollars get accumulated, mm-hmm. but even better would be outperformance over the index. What we've done is we've looked at 43 different equity portfolios over 14 years, and that amounted to over 9,000 of these trading episodes, these positions in portfolios. And the average holding period for each of those was just under a year. So these are long-term investment or mm-hmm. quasi-long-term investment. Yeah. They're not trading. Right. They're not trades anyway. And these are from, you know, real active fund managers. And so what we did was analyze sort of the game tape of every single one of these positions and said, you know, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to every one of them. Where does the alpha happen? Does it happen consistently throughout the life of the episode, and which is what you would hope, right? And in some cases, we found that that was the case. And we called the people who did that on average linear accumulators. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of holy grail of alpha creation. But there were far more people who were not linear accumulators. And on balance, people do generate alpha early in the life of their ideas, but the tendency is to give that back and to more than give it back in a lot of cases. So we saw some people who made a little burst of alpha generation at the beginning of the holding and then held on for a long period of underperformance before just giving up altogether. We called those the hopeless romantics. And then we had the coasters, and those are the ones who generate alpha in the first half of the life of the episode. And then it just sort of peters out. It doesn't get destroyed and go back to zero, but you're not making anything more. You're probably giving up a little bit very slowly over the second half of life. And if nothing else, it's just an inefficient use of your capital. But and then the fourth one, if we're counting, is the round tripper. And that is where you make a bunch of money and then you give it all back. And it looks like a inverted horseshoe. And that was actually the profile when you put every single one of these portfolios together. That was the profile that came out, which was pretty depressing when you think about it.
Yeah, and sure.
It got the research we put out got a lot of press coverage, which was great. But the press's inclination was to use this as another stick.
Active managers.
Right. Yeah. They can't, you know, you're paying them to lose you money. Right. Basically, right. Is the message. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't how we were looking at it at all. You know, and maybe that's just the nature of our team being very optimistic, but we're also ex-fund managers. And so we're always looking at opportunities and advantages. And what we saw was that, you know, before they give up the alpha they've made, the fund managers do generate over 100 basis points, 120 basis points of alpha at the portfolio level per annum, which is way more than enough to offset 75 basis points of fees on average.
Yeah.
The problem is that they give it back, right? So if you could analyze a given fund manager's alpha life cycle and show him or her, here's the point where your ideas tend to run out of steam. You could nudge them and ask them, you know, a couple questions that they said they wanted to be asked the next time they were in this situation that may cause them to make a better decision than they have made historically. And what, and we do this with our clients, and we found it is extremely effective, because it doesn't mean that therefore they always cut every position at the exact peak moment of alpha generation, because it's unrealistic, and the control is still with them. You know, it's not like they're always going to do what a computer tells them to do.
Right.
All the computer does is say, heads up, it's that time in the life of this position where you need to make a decision about whether you stay or you go. And if we've shown you in the past that you've had a tendency to overstay your welcome, let's say in a situation where you've made a lot of money before, you love the management team, you know the story really well. I mean, that's often where this sort of thing happens, because we get a bit complacent and we stop asking the tough questions. And before you know it, the party has been over for an hour and you're still sitting there, you know. So if we can just get you to consider that an hour earlier, or, you know, in this case, there's a 6-month window we found on average that if these PMs took profits any time in that 6-month window, they would have been 120 basis points of alpha better off per annum, which is huge, you know?
Right.
But you need to know that you're in it. You need to know you're in the 6 months in order to do something about it.
Well, there's two things that have to happen, right? The first thing is that they have to acknowledge that maybe the staleness of the idea. But then also, I think more importantly is, all right, now you need to come up with a new idea, right? To come up with that starting point again to get you into that sweet spot of where the alpha generation is for that particular time period, right? You know, kind of like back to January 1st again.
Exactly. And, you know, if you're an individual and you don't have a mandate where you can't hold cash, then that's a little easier. You can, you know, take profits in one thing and just sit and wait while you find your next idea. But if you're a professional fund manager, often you don't have that ability. You're not getting paid to sit on cash, and you'll get in trouble if you do that. So you have to have the other side of that trade lined up. And that means you better have a pipeline, you know, a research pipeline and a bench of new ideas, which is something that a lot of fund managers struggle with because they're relying on other parts of the organization for that.
Yeah. So now the whole goal here is not necessarily by any design other than the fact that, you know, this whole passive indexing, lazy strategy that has been developed and has been pressed for over the years is all about the index. And, you know, then if it's not so good, well, you beat it then, right? That's the kind of the whole thing. And active managers historically have not only because of fees, maybe because of other issues with regard to the portfolio design. But again, if you are trying to beat the index, which is that is your baseline thesis for what you're doing to give alpha and give better performance and maybe even risk adjusted performance that's better than the index, that's what it's all about. But what is this beating the index thing? Where did that come from?
Well, it's interesting. The index providers have a lot to be held accountable for, you could argue. The history is, I think, baked into how pension fund consultants need to have a benchmark against which to measure whether, you know, an investment manager is delivering value, because the alternative is to buy the S&P 500,
right,
or, you know, whatever index. It wasn't always the case that those alternatives existed. You know, the S&P 500's had index funds and ETFs for a long time, but there are loads of indices around the world that, you know, don't necessarily have a simple alternative. Slowly but surely, those are getting eaten away, and new products are coming out to mimic them. But even so, you had the use of a benchmark as a way of measuring who's good and who's not good, The problem is the benchmarks themselves are inherently flawed
in their basic composition. So you have, for example, you mentioned the S&P 500 index or the NASDAQ index. These are cap weighted indexes that are favoring the large cap in them. And it creates this vicious cycle of, well, if we want to get there, we're going to have to at least have as much Apple that's in the benchmark. I'm going to have at least as much Microsoft that's in the benchmark, because obviously those are, you know, I think Microsoft, the top five names in terms of market cap size in the S&P 500 contributed 20% of the overall performance to the index last year. That's incredible. And if you didn't have those five stocks, you could have easily been off. And that's 6%, by the way, of the total return. If you didn't have those, you could be 1-3% under.
Yeah.
Unless you did some incredible dancing around the edges, right? So
yeah. And it's self-fulfilling, right?
Exactly.
Because the more money that goes into these index funds, the higher the prices rise and the more outsized the biggest names are in the context. So yeah, you can see that there's something inefficient about that from an economic standpoint, and that there will be an opportunity on the other side of it. And I mean, I can already see it in fund managers who trade things like utilities. The game has changed very much because they have to worry about flows into and out of ETFs and index funds. And that's actually what drives the share prices in the names that they're covering. That
right.
wasn't the case, you know, not that long ago. So they're watching that, but they're also watching for arbitrage opportunities. And, you know, the index rebalancing is a predictable event. So, you know, there are entire strategies that are being developed around that. And so at some point, that's got to unwind.
that's the problem. And it's funny because I had wondered before we started talking about this, I was like, you know, this whole indexing, and is it creating the potential for bubbles in certain areas? And then is that creating mental skews? Is that creating, you know, almost a fear to the average investor or the money manager that I have to be in those securities, whether I like them or not? Whether you believe that Apple is going to be able to meet up with its earnings according to what they had from, let's say, 6 months ago to where we are today, and the stock price and the expansion of the valuation based on a multiple expansion, I don't think they're going to meet that. But you know what? I don't know if I can not be invested in that. They're the number one cap. They have an outsized amount of positioning in there, and how can I not be in there to at least a little bit, right? You follow what I'm saying? And it kind of creates this inability, not from a closet benchmarking or closet indexing standpoint, but from a reality standpoint of, like, if you are trying to beat the benchmark, because what you want to do is do the best thing for your client, which, by the way, in turn gives you the best returns for yourself and your clients and for your income overall and for your firm and for your growth and for your stability and for your long-term ability to stay in business. How could you not have Apple in your portfolio as an example of one stock, right? And it creates this kind of, I think, a problem. And I just wonder where this all goes.
And it's sort of uncharted territory. I mean, we just haven't had this situation at this extreme before. And we haven't also had so many computers participating in the market. So, you know, there's what would you and I feel about, I don't know, not having Apple in our portfolio, or if Apple suddenly starts to underperform for some sustained period of time, what we would do. And we might have varying views on that. But a computer, you know, there's a lot of computers out there that have rules built in that as soon as a given name shows, you know, a change in momentum, they're a seller. And so the downward momentum gets stronger and stronger. So you could expect to see sharper moves out of some of these names when they do start to come off the boil. And then it'll be interesting to see what does that do to the index composition and how fast, you know, how fast does it happen?
So since we last talked, I have been very much watching this whole, I don't even know what it's called, but this growth an interest in the area of ESG, environmental, social, and governance, that I think it was since we last talked, I spent a little time with some firms looking into this, understanding what it was all about, and then trying to pinpoint, well, what does this mean? And I realized that in the world that we live in now that seems to want to attach onto any social or any kind of item that is, you know, going to be popular and exciting and really engulf the masses, this is going to be something that really needs to be watched here. And I'm betting that a lot of the firms that you are talking to, that they are having to and being forced to include some of the analysis from the ESG standpoint into what they do. Is that a correct statement?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, it is.
And so it's happening fast.
Well, you first saw, you know, this sort of burst of activity around ESG fund launches, and that's been going on for a few years now, probably longer in Europe than in the U.S., but it is, you know, that's like a whole sector of the fund management market in and of itself. And it's an interesting one because there's not a lot of standardization yet around how do you define socially responsible, you know, how do you define these things and how do you benchmark it, right? Then the benchmark providers get involved and say, well, we'll be the arbiter of what is good and what is not good in an ESG type of sense. And that's only just starting to happen. It's still a pretty immature market. But at the same time, you're also seeing particularly wealth managers, and I work with large discretionary fund managers, but you know, some of them work for very big wealth managers. And they're trying to appeal to a new generation of investor who cares about things that the previous generation did not prioritize, like the environment or social responsibility, or, you know, that there's a sea change in what the market demands, and younger people are increasingly putting it on their, you know, list of top three things I care about when I'm choosing a wealth manager. You know, are these people socially responsible? Do they show, you know, that they're engaged on that ESG level? And so it's becoming just part of how you have to put yourself forward if you want to appeal to that crowd. But it also means doing a lot more work because...
Or it means finding a way to, you know, do virtue signaling to make it look like you are very socially conscious. And already I've been hearing that there's a lot of companies that are trying to game the system already to increase their ESG score on a variety of levels. And that would, in their eyes, hope to have inclusion in the, you know, socially responsible or ESG friendly, or the you know, when you get the stamp of approval from an ESG standpoint for an index. And that is going to be, I think, another area that is going to, well, everything gets gamed, right? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
You got to find out where the game is. But is this going to be a tail wagging the dog scenario coming up where people are going to get overwhelmed by trying to understand the whole ESG environment? Because as you mentioned, index reconstitution and rebalancing, there's going to be seemingly a forcible, it seems to me, a forcible change happening with what is going to be included in a particular index. And it's going to be another layer of fundamentals that are based on ESG.
Well, and if nothing else, it's costly to a fund manager to have to monitor all of that, keep, you know.
You need a whole other team. Use.
Yeah, you need a whole other team. Or, you know, a whole layer of research people whose job it is to look at that. And it can't just be a computer that looks at the ESG scores that are spat out by other computers, because if people are gaming it with SEO and, you know, putting the right keywords into various things that the computers are analyzing, then you're just going to end up getting duped. So, yeah, it's, you know, if anybody thinks these managers don't work hard for their money, they're sorely mistaken.
Right. Well, this definitely is going to be the thing it's a thing with quotes, thing that is going to be developing. And I've talked to my listeners about this, that it is going to be something that's going to be very much watched, because, you know, now you're going to have, who knows what kind of maybe hiring private detectives. You know, don't forget, there's been a lot of things like looking at flight plans of CEOs to where they're going. Some hedge funds and some players out there, they're meeting in Allentown, and that's the home of this company, and therefore maybe there's a merger happening. And the other stock, you know, the merging firm and the acquisition firm starts moving on that news. I just wonder if you're going to see that, if there is some, we see that there is some, look who's friends with who on their Facebook, or what comments were made, or look who's going out, these spies around taking pictures of the CEO and maybe somebody having lunch that maybe isn't, maybe, you know, they're having lunch with this person too many times. And that may mean more than just a professional relationship.
I mean, it's kind of crazy, isn't it?
The world is nuts.
But it's all data. Yeah. And if that data is available because you have, you know, flight plans that people can get a hold of, or I don't know. I mean, a lot of it would likely be illegal to look at somebody's location based on their cell phone. But, you know, there's stuff you can do in between. And you certainly see this with the data providers who do things like satellite imagery about how many cars are in a given parking lot or whatever.
Well, the cranes in a particular area. It was much easier when there was 13 channels. See, I think the downfall of our society was the advent of the change from the car seat that you could move just forward and backward to now you have a million different positions you can have. There's too many choices, too many things to know, you know?
But aren't you so comfortable in your car?
I'm never comfortable because I'm only, maybe it's not in the right spot. Maybe I got to move it a little bit this way, a little bit that way, a little bit up, a little bit down, you know?
It actually, there has been some academic research around this point that people are much happier when they don't have too many choices.
Yeah, just let me go forward and backward, man. That's it. That's all I want. I want to sit there and I don't have a choice. It's like, okay, I don't have to worry about, am I comfortable or not? Because, well,
it is what it is.
I am comfortable. It is. That's what I'm supposed to be. So behavioral finance trends. I mean, how long is it going to be until machines can do a lot of the jobs of, well, you're part of this, by the way. You're part of an art of, you know, this is what you do. You know, really understanding, I mean, fully the whole, you know, the whole insight and the whole behavioral, the analytics behind it. And maybe you're there with how investors really work and then utilizing that for both benefiting and increasing the opportunities and alpha as you describe it, and then working on the other side of that as well, like knowing, okay, well, they're going to do this then, therefore I'll trade the other side.
Well, you know, I think we still need humans, right? For a
do
lot.
We? Do we?
we
do. Okay.
Investing in the market, I think we do. Now, in a quant fund, there're plenty of humans, right? They're people who are coding. They're not necessarily making discretionary investment decisions. But there's no quant model that just gets set and, you know, set it and forget it and come back in 20 years and you're a billionaire. Like, it doesn't work like that. So the models need to be constantly tweaked because the market is not predictable for any length of time, and whatever repeatable thing they manage to figure out goes away after a certain amount of time. So they have to keep iterating on it. And so there's a whole raft of humans that will end up shifting from being employed in, you know, sort of traditional stock picking type roles into quant roles. Mm-hmm. And it's probably not the same people, but that's a generation that's shifting in the asset management industry right now. And you can see it with the graduate trainees that are coming in. Like, you don't have a job if you don't have Python. You know, it's just part of it.
So
now
you have to have a snake. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would say some coding skills would be more useful than a snake. But, you know, the profile of what the market is looking for has changed. But there's also still an opportunity for people who want to do fundamental investing and actually, you know, pick up on things that aren't picked up from computers that are reading, you know, quarterly statements and regulatory filings. Mm-hmm. There's only so much you can get out of that. And there will be, I think, for the foreseeable future, room for some humans, not as many as there have been in the past, but some, to do deep fundamental research and get ahead of the computers that are just reading filing information.
Mm. Yeah.
So I don't think the humans go away, but I do think that fewer of them will be doing it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, I hear you. So where can people get in touch with you and how can they find out more information? We'll have some information over on the show notes for episode number 646 of The Disciplined Investor on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But let me hear from you.
Yeah, you can come download white papers and research papers like the Alpha Life Cycle one that we were talking about before. And I think last time we spoke, we were talking about how people behave when they're on a winning streak or a losing streak. Yep. We have a research paper about that. So we do this research across our client base, and we put out these papers that are really interesting, and they're free. So if you go to www.essentia, which is like essential but without the L, -analytics.com, essentia-analytics.com, you will find all of that stuff, and you can join the mailing list to get more quarterly publications.
Great information. I want to thank you again, Claire Flynn Levy from Essentia Analytics. We'll do it again soon.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. That's going to wrap it up for this week. That was pretty enjoyable, pretty interesting. I think that the idea that we want to have something written down, some accountability for what we do so we can repeat our successes and discard our failures, I think that's really something important. But more so, the nudging idea is pretty cool, where you can get an idea of, hey, you're making this mistake again. Knock, knock. Hello. Don't do it. So pretty cool stuff from Claire. With that, we're going to end it. And if you have any questions, of course, you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew button, and I'll be happy to put together some of those questions for a show in the near future, as well as answer those directly for you. Check out investology.com, where we have our robo-esque style of advice on a global allocation basis, and it blends the best of robo and focused and direct management by an actual advisor. That's why we call it technology enhanced and advisor crafted, or advisor crafted and technology enhanced. But bottom line, it's pretty cool. We'll see you again, well, next week. Thanks. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.